It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 406. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. Got a great voicemail comment that I'll be playing later on. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show, and Facebook, send me a friend request. Follow me on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. And don't forget about the wiki, which has links to all of the past shows and show notes and information about my show and the equipment that I use and software that I use. And that is at mtswiki.com. I have, again, jam-packed show, some Windows 7 tips. I want to talk about lots of updates. This has been an update week, and there's some important updates, and there's some Mac and Apple things I want to talk about. I want to catch up on email. We're going to get started. This Windows 7 tip is because of its modular design. And as modules can contain other modules of components of Windows 7, it's fairly easy to be able to turn on and off features. It's something that a lot of people forget. You can easily go into turn on and off Windows features by going to Control Panel. Then I always like to pick large icons in the upper right-hand side. Then go to Programs and Features. Then on the far left-hand side, click Turn Windows Features On and Off. And you can easily just literally check a box and turn a feature on and off. An example, Internet Explorer 8, Indexing Service, Media Features, Microsoft Message Queuing Server, Print and Document Services, Remote Differential Compression, Rip Listener, on and on. There's lots of advanced features where you can go in and just turn them on and off. So that's Windows tip number one. Number two, you can easily add system icons to your desktop. We take for granted in XP, there was lots of icons that you would always by default be presented with. And it was very easy in XP to just right click on the desktop and then go to customize desktop and you could check the boxes. But in Windows 7, it's hidden a little bit. So what if you want to turn off the recycle bin or add it or do some of add some of those other icons that you're used to seeing on some of the older operating systems? Well, you can easily add them. And this would help if you're working with someone who's been their XP and they're familiar with some of these icons. You can make the desktop look a little bit like their older desktop. And you simply right-click on the desktop and then select Personalize. Then in the left pane of the personalization window, click Change Desktop Icons under the Tasks heading. Then click Customize Desktop. This opens the desktop icon settings dialog box, and you can easily add and remove computer, user files, recycle bin, control panel, and network. So this is where you can make those changes and get the desktop customized the way you want. So that's our Windows 7 tips for the night. There's been lots of updates that I noticed this week. An important one that you want to, everybody who's an Evernote user, Evernote 4.5.6 is updated for the PC, the Mac, updated. It's also updated, I know, for any of your other devices too. So stay on top of the Evernote updates because they keep adding features. We're going to talk about them in a couple minutes. Apple has released the iOS 5.1.1 update, and this fixes some serious vulnerabilities. Apple's latest update to the iOS, it just came out, and the version 5.1.1 is more than just a cosmetic fix. It patches at least three security flaws, all of which should be considered serious. And this is according to Apple. The update is available for the iPhone 4S, the 4, the 3GS, and 3rd and 4th generation iPod touches, and all of the iPad models. It improves reliability of using the HDR option for photos, and this is taken using the lock screen shortcut. It addresses bugs that could prevent the new iPad from switching between 2G and 3G networks. It fixes bugs that affected AirPlay video playback in some circumstances, and it improved reliability for syncing Safari bookmarks. There's a reading list fix and issues unable to... It fixes the unable to purchase alert, which could be displayed after you successfully purchased an app. So that's kind of annoying. I've actually seen that bug. So all the bug fixes, and something I've been reading today, it seems to, they don't mention that it improves power management, but their ongoing improvements to power management, certainly you should be encouraged to continue to always update. A big update for OS X and Snow Leopard, but we're going to talk about the OS X update for the Mac, which is 10.7.4. And on Wednesday, they released this update. There are some improvements, but there's also some security fixes. It's a 729 meg update. When you update, it resolves issues that if you notice anytime you were closing your Mac, you would always get the box checked, regardless if you checked it or not, to reopen Windows when logging back in. And it's always enabled. They fixed that. Then they improve compatibility with certain British third-party USB keyboards. I could care less about that. They address an issue that may prevent files from being saved to a server, and they improve the reliability of copying files to an SMB server, which is what I do all the time. So it's how I transfer files back and forth to my iMac. So I updated my iMac and my MacBook Pro, no issues. So that's something that you definitely want to consider. This is interesting. When you're done updating OS X for, you know, I know this is more Windows podcast, but I got to talk about this because it's an interesting thing that Apple has done with their Safari browser. They've updated the Safari browser after you update to 10.7.4. Here's what they changed in the, besides improvements to performance. They made a change that if you are using an older version of Flash, it will automatically be turned off and deactivated within Safari. So if you have Adobe Flash and you are not using the latest version, it will disable Flash in the browser until you upgrade to the latest version. That's very interesting with all of the flaws and the problems with Adobe Flash, which, by the way, you should absolutely be upgrading to the latest version. You should be at least, as of today's show that I'm recording this, 11.2.202.235. That is the latest and greatest Adobe Flash player. And the reason is that you want to update to that is there are some major security flaws in the previous versions of Flash. Now, one of the things, what if you absolutely had to use an older version? Apple doesn't recommend doing this, but they have a procedure for you to be able to activate the older version. but they do not recommend it. But they do have instructions on how to re-enable the older version. I'm glad that they built that in there, because you can't just blindly say, okay, you have to have the latest version. They can't force everybody to do that. By default, I'm glad they're doing that, because it does make the browser more secure. And it's very interesting. And I'm wondering if we're going to see that kind of feature in Chrome, in Firefox, in Internet Explorer. So very interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. Enough with the updates. How about some acquisitions that's happened? I never talk about this, but there were two that just caught my eye. And one is Evernote acquired the iPad app Penultimate. I love Penultimate. It was an inexpensive app that allowed me to draw and write with my finger on my iPad. I love it. I use it all the time. And now that Evernote bought them, you're going to be able to use your finger. Think about that. Within Evernote, I like it. Good acquisition for Evernote. Here's one that, for me, the jury's still out. I don't know how this is going to play. Dell acquired SonicWall. Now, I have a couple clients with SonicWall firewalls, so let's see how they do with the acquisition and the support, because I was not a big fan of the initial SonicWall support as it stands. So is Dell going to help it, or is it going to get worse? I don't know. Is the licensing going to be a little better? Because I never liked the SonicWall licensing for the features that you needed, and I thought they charged too much. Let's see what happens now that Dell has acquired them. And are they going to have better pricing and better availability for some of these features? I'll be keeping an eye on that. And in the pre-show, I was mentioning that look for a future show as I get deeper involved in Untangle and the Untangle appliance for a client. I'm also going to be exploring that for the free distribution that you can build your own Untangle firewall and web content filtering, which is what that is. There's also something that I put in last week's show notes, but I forgot when I was recording the show. I knew there was an open source project for being able to re-image systems, and I couldn't remember what it was. It's called Fog, and it's the Fog project. The link is in last week's show notes, but that's something that I also absolutely have to start doing. I have clients that are in need of that solution, and I am going to carve out time in my schedule to build those products and test them, because there's money to be made there, and I have clients that are in need of those services. Well, now that I'm caught up on the news and events and some of the updates that I wanted to talk about, give a listen to this. It's a 6-minute message. It was actually two separate voicemail messages that I put together from Paul, who's a regular contributor to the show, but he has some interesting comments in follow-up to a couple of the things that I've been talking about in previous shows. So give a listen.
Hey, Mike, this is Paul from San Antonio calling again. I just had a quick comment to your latest show. You made a comment about a shared printer over the network when you're sharing it through a PC using Windows 7, and how to disable the advanced sharing setting that requires a username and password. You already mentioned this, but I just wanted to reiterate that this is not something recommended if you're on a business network using a work group or peer-to-peer type network. If you go over to a domain, this setting wouldn't make a difference anyway, because that level of security is managed by the server. This, though, what you mentioned is the equivalent to simple versus classic file sharing that's available in Windows XP. Simple just means that you're basically using the guest account to authenticate yourself on the network with other computers. That works with files, folders, and printers that are being shared. So it will never prompt you for a username or password. It just uses the guest account with no password to grant you access. It's basically a bypassing issue with the permissions for the shared resource. In Windows XP, you can accomplish the same thing by opening up the My Computer window going up to Tools, Folder Options, and then View. And if you scroll down to the very last option, there's the recommended option of using Simple File Sharing. It'll say recommended because, again, that's for simple work groups, peer-to-peer, basically in your home. If you're doing any kind of business use, especially if you have client information, anything sensitive, you definitely want to uncheck that, which will switch you over to classic file sharing. And what that does is exactly that. It requires username and password for every shared resource on the network. In a peer-to-peer network, those permissions are set by each individual computer that's presenting the share. So you will have to have a matching username and password for that share, whether it's a printer, folder, or file. This is one of the common mistakes people make when sharing their PCs in their home, is they leave it set to simple, and then if you put restrictions on a shared resource, other machines on the network will not be able to access them. Again, keep that in mind. If you're using simple on one machine and classic on another, they will have trouble sharing items back and forth. On your show, you also had somebody mention the idea of using a boot disk or a distro, Linux distro of Ubuntu, to boot into that and use it to access the hard drive, navigate to the startup folder, and put a security tool in there so that it runs when Windows boots, or the system startup is the way he mentioned it. The problem with that is that things boot up in a certain order after post is completed. When you boot a machine up, it has to hand everything over to Windows. What's in the startup folders is done after Windows itself loads. The startup that applies to everybody, if you go under in Windows XP, Documents and Settings, and go to All Users, in Vista, Windows 7, it's just the users folder. There's a common folder in there for all users called startup. There's also a startup folder for each individual user. Basically, Windows loads first. It then loads services, then goes, or actually, those are pretty much done at the same time. That then, once a user is logged in, which may require you actually selecting your username or typing it in and entering your password, then that's when the all users startup runs, then the startup for the individual user that's logging on. So that's the order that things go in. If the infection that you're trying to fix has installed itself as a server, or service, I should say, or server application, then this will not work because services are loaded up prior to any user logging on. Even if you don't have a password set up and you automatically log into a user, that order is still respected. So Windows will start up, the infection will start as a service, then the startup applications go. So if the infection prevents them from running or infects all executables, then you're already sunk there before you even log in. One way around that would be to, instead of using the startup folder, maybe edit the boot INI file so that it runs a tool that runs when Windows boots before services are run. The problem is most tools are designed to run under Windows. You need Windows to run first in order to run anything like Malwarebytes, SuperNTest Spyware, or CombofX, any of those. So the better option is to use a rescue disk, which most you can get them for free from AVG, Kaspersky, and others. What I prefer is the Ultimate Boot CD for Windows. It not only has several of these security tools, but it's also got other diagnostics so you can check your hard drive, check your memory, and reset passwords, and do many other things. Run benchmarks, check the health of your hardware, and you can even access the internet and basically just run the system off that boot disk. It's a little more complicated to set up, but you gain a lot more power and ability. I almost always am able to completely clean up a machine just using that disk alone, working outside of Windows. Then I just do a few repairs of Windows when I rebooted it back in, and I'm good to go. So that's my recommendation. The startup folder is useless if you have an infection that starts itself as a service. Thanks. Bye.
That was a couple great tips there. What he just finished talking about, what is the order of execution when Windows starts up? It sounded like a great idea to go in, you know, boot with a Linux distribution, get into the startup of the system, get to that menu, get to that folder, and put like a combo fix so then the system will automatically start. He's right. The infection will kick off before that and probably stop combo fix from working. I like his recommendation for the Ultimate Boot CD. That's great. But I'm telling, if you have a system that is unbelievably infected, that is just overcome with an infection, take the drive out of the system. Go plug it into the cable. And this is a great segue. The cables that I mentioned and the little adapter, I mentioned that $5 case that you can buy from Amazon, I found for a link for you to be able to just easily take a 3.5-inch hard drive. 20 of you purchased it using my link, and I thank you so very much. And a lot of you purchased the IDE cable. Thank you. And that was great. And I love finding those little things. And I'm so glad you liked that and bought them and used my link, because my Amazon link, that is a great way to support the show. If you know anyone or yourself buying anything from Amazon, send them to amazon.mikenation.net or write to my website at miketechshow.com. MikeNation.net, and click on the Amazon icon on the left-hand side, and your price is the same, and a commission will come to the Mike Tech Show, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so very much, and keep on doing that. You guys rock. Thank you so much for supporting the show like that. You can use that cable, IDE to SATA, SATA to USB cable. It's so inexpensive. Take the drive out of the system. Put that, connect that, and then go and clean the drive as an external drive and throw your whole gambit of all of your cleaning tools and use that, and now clean the drive and then put the drive back in the system. That's probably the easiest way to do this. But sometimes it's too hard to get a drive out of a computer, and I understand that. I don't like messing with that. But it's why I like working with some of the newer Dell Optiplexes. Matter of fact, a lot of the Dell systems where it's toolless entry. I love workstations that require no tools, and you want to add memory and the memory's not hidden. How great is that when you can just pull a lever and open the side of a computer and pop the memory in, or and just pinch something with your fingers and pop a drive out and just remove the cables? Oh, I love that. We want to continue to support manufacturers that make modular systems like that, that anybody who's supporting those computers, it makes life easy for us to work on them. And it's why I support those Dell systems and the Dell Optiplex, because it makes my life easy when I got to go back and work on these systems. Let's get to some email. This is from Matthew, and he has a question. Hi, Mike. First off, I would like to tell you that I enjoy your show very much. I came across it this week and have been listening to a lot of your past shows. I was able to come across your show in some research that I'm doing for my own business. I have my own computer repair service sales business that is located in a small town of New Hampshire. I have been doing this full time now for almost 8 years. Although I am at a bit of a standstill, I have noticed over the past year or so that new and repeat business has dropped off quite a bit. I work mostly with end users due to the fact that I am a one-man show here. I have a small retail shop that I have to run on regular hours and find it difficult to support some business clients due to this. I was wondering if you could give me some insight on how to generate new business. I am operating on limited funds right now and need help building the business back up. The last thing I want is to ever have to work for someone ever again, especially if it's a job I don't like. I love my job and my freedom and just want to do my best at keeping it going. Thanks so much and keep up the great work, Matt. Wow, Matt, I understand your predicament. How do you service business clients when you can't leave your retail shop? You're going to have to get another body. And here's your choice. Either you get a body that you can train to go out and service those business clients while you mind the store, or Is there any chance you can get someone that's that's close to you, that's a relative, that's someone you trust implicitly, that can at least watch the shop while you go work on obtaining new business and business clients? You're absolutely right. It's why I don't have a shop, but I take care of my business clients where I am able to go out and I can get and work on any business client that I want to get and work on. And most of my revenue is from business clients and small businesses. And I support their servers, their workstations, their networks. And I'm not maintaining a shop and I don't have all that overhead. Maybe that's where you need to head. But I understand having the shop and wanting that. Ways to generate revenue. Inexpensive devices that are easy to sell. That inexpensive laser printer that you can have a stack of them right there and you could just say, here, you know, buy that. Having good, inexpensive backup solutions that you can make a profit on that are right there in the shop. Don't know exactly what you have and what kind of inventory you have, and if certainly you want to keep your inventory down, but you want to keep your markup as high as it can be by still offering a great product, like network cables, just a small example. You can purchase them from Monoprice, resell them at an incredible markup, and still beat the pants off any of the big shops for what they sell cables for. So look at those products that are very, very low cost, offer good value, and then have an incredible markup for you. Uncle Al in the chat's mentioning cartridges. You should be selling a ton of cartridges with that, you know. Now, I don't know what the overhead in terms of what markup is on those, but certainly inkjet printers that you sell, make sure you are the one providing the supplies. The problem with that, though, you're competing with the Staples and those places that you might not be able to buy them and inventory them at the margin. So that might be something that's a little tougher. But your choice to embrace businesses, you got to be able to send someone on site, or you have to go on site, which means someone has to be minding the store. Or maybe it's time to close the store and go to 100% consulting model, where you are personally visiting clients, that you now don't have all that overhead, but you can still expand your business. That might be an option. I don't know if I'm giving you some things to think about, but stay in touch, Matt, and let me know. Thanks for, I'm glad you found the show and you're listening. But keep in touch with me on how you're making out. I'd love to know. All right. This is from David, and he has a problem with website access. Hi, and thank you for your podcast. For a while now, I have not been able to go to the T-Mobile.com homepage to log into my account. I can log on to the T-Mobile.com login page, but not the homepage. If I go to T-Mobile.com on a fresh install of a web browser, then I can go to the homepage all day long. But if I log in, then log out, and go back to the homepage, I get the following error. And it's a server error in, and it has a slash application. And this is the URL address that it is shown. If you can help me, that would be great. I have tried just about everything that I can think of. One of the things that you need to do is certainly try a different browser. Try clearing the cache out using a program like CCleaner and cleaning out all of the cache, all of the settings. If you're using Internet Explorer, go to the settings and do a total reset of the browser. And let it delete everything. Let it disable all of the add-ins and get a fresh default setup of Internet Explorer. And then go to the page and then see what you can do. That fixes a lot of problems. Cleaning out everything, cleaning out the temp files, running the full gambit of the options within CCleaner certainly may fix this problem. So let me know if that helps, David. This is from Mark Smith, and he says, application virtualization to run old programs on a new OS. I have not used this application virtualization program myself, but it might be just what you need to run those old XP programs in Windows 7. And he has two links. One is thindownload.com, so www.thindownload.com, and the other one is www.evalaze.de/en/home. I'll have the links in the show notes, but this is application virtualization, something to think about. This is from Ken, and he says, hi, Mike. I discovered you last year, and I love your show. I'm in San Diego, so I usually don't get home in time to watch it live, but I listen to your podcast in the car. I've been working with IT for over 30 years, going back to mainframes. I've come up through Novell and Microsoft, and I'm certified in VMware, but now most of my clients are quite small. Over the years, I searched for solutions that could manage IT operations and documentation, besides spreadsheets and post-it notes. Most small companies never even think about this. I love Spiceworks, and it is usually the first thing I introduce into a new client if they don't already have it. However, as good as Spiceworks has become, it still doesn't hit the mark. Over the years, I gained a vision of what I thought a good tool would look like. A friend and I have put something together, and I thought I might get some feedback from you and your listeners. An IT network is a linked set of hardware, software, services, licenses, and people with a load of detail. I wanted a tool that followed all those links and where you could drill down to anything from anywhere. This tool would serve as a central place to keep all IT information, and once populated, it could be used to plan, schedule, important dates, renewals, expirations, etc., activities and tasks. We've put together a prototype of what this tool might look like and have been working on it part-time for a couple years. I'm now using it at my existing clients along with Spiceworks. It not only helps me keep everything organized, I find it has been a pretty good sales tool also. I sell the product Helm, and you can link to a YouTube demo and I'm going to put this link in the show notes. I'm getting a little long in the tooth to be crawling under desks, and I'd like to focus on organizing clients around Spiceworks and Helm. I also run across small companies where the current IT person is technically great, but doesn't have a clue how to organize or document a network. Helm is very flexible in letting you create recurring tasks, firmware checks, backup tests, UPS battery tests, etc., and list them chronologically on a dashboard. I've thought of many more things I could do with Helm, but I figured I'd better see if anyone else thought it was a good idea first. I think it's a great idea. I've watched this, and I encourage anybody that's interested in a tool like this to check it out. I know you're busy, and I appreciate your time. Keep up the good work. Here's what we're going to do for Ken. I encourage you all to click on this link and send me recommendations for Ken to improve this tool. What would you like to do? Now, the first thing that I'm recommending is we don't get into how he can populate this program. Are there ways that we can use the Sydi project, SYDI, acquire all the information on a network and a system? And wouldn't it be great to populate Helm? I guess I'm talking to Ken here, who sent me this. Do we have to manually get all of this in there, or do you allow for ways to import this information. He has a great starting point here with this tool when you look at it. Ken, I hope if you really make a go of this project, keep the price reasonably priced and keep it open enough for upgrades where as you grow the product, it will upgrade. Are you thinking open source first or at least shareware or some type of a medium to get it out there? I know there's a lot of Mike Tech Show listeners that are very, very, very interested in a tool like this. I'm interested in it. We might be creating something really good here with Ken, and this is a great avenue to have some input into the development of a tool that can really make what we're doing very helpful in organizing all these tasks, tracking the computers and the workstations. When you see this, it's a really, really good idea. And I'm very curious on what your feedback is. And let's share this with Ken and let's see if this can become a full-blown project that we can all share in and use. That's great. And Ken, thank you for sending this and bringing it to my attention. And let's see what the Mike Tech Show family can do for you. And let's see if we can get a kick butt product out there that can help us with our IT management and consulting. That's a great idea. All right. That is it for tonight's show. I want to thank you for downloading and listening to the show. I really appreciate it. No music tonight. That's it. I'll be back next week. Same time, same channel. See you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.